We're in Lamentations, and last week we did 1 and 2. This week we will do 3, and then probably next week finish up with 4 and 5. To sort of get everybody up to speed, it isn't clear who wrote Lamentations. The consensus is it was probably Jeremiah. And as we go through chapter 3 tonight, I'm going to take the perspective that it's Jeremiah who is writing. He's writing in the first person. It is obviously a lament over the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah done by Nebuchadnezzar on his second trip down. The book is broken into 5 poems, 1 poem per chapter. The first and second chapters are each 22 verses, and the fourth and fifth are each 22, and then this one in the middle is 66. This one is an alphabetical poem. There are 3 verses per Hebrew letter. The comment was, of course, that the first 2 chapters and the last 2 are also alphabetical since they have 22 verses apiece. And then the one in the middle is 3 verses per letter as opposed to 1. The poems are written in response to the destruction of Jerusalem. This one in the middle, chapter 3, appears to be the lamentation of Jeremiah personally as opposed to for the city. As you all know very well, being a prophet is tough duty. We just finished going through Jeremiah, and he got thrown in a pit. He got thrown in the stocks. He had people trying to shut him up. So he had a kind of a rough time as a prophet, as most true prophets do. So this reads very much like the book of Job, where the prophet is complaining to God about the stuff that's happened to him. This is different than the other 4 in that there is hope in this one. 1 and 2 was things are terrible, we deserve it, you are righteous, and that's pretty much it. In this one, we get a ray of hope that God will restore at some point in the future. So Lamentations 3. I am the man who has seen affliction. Under the rod of his wrath, he has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me he turns his hand again and again the whole day long. I'm assuming, is Jeremiah. He is God. That's why I say it reads very much like Job. Verse 4. He has made my flesh and my skin waste away. He has broken my bones. He has besieged and enveloped me with bitterness and tribulation. He has made me dwell in darkness like the dead of long ago. Jeremiah's bones, as far as I know, were not actually broken. This is obviously biblical hyperbole. God has dealt very severely with him, and I would read that as if he had broken my bones. Verse 7, he has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He has made my chains heavy. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. He has blocked my ways with blocks of stone. He has made my paths crooked. So I regard this as the lot of a prophet. Because you remember, as we were in Jeremiah, what the prophet said was, get out of the city, flee, surrender to the Babylonians, because if you don't surrender to the Babylonians, you're going to die. If you do surrender to the Babylonians, they will take you as a captive and haul you off to Babylon, but at least you will save your life. Jeremiah doesn't have that option. He has got to stay right where he is. So the idea that God has put blocks at all the entrances, as far as Jeremiah is concerned, he doesn't have any option but to stay there and continue to utter prophecies as God gives them to him. So we're all the way down to verse 10 now. He is a bear lying in wait for me, a lion in hiding. He turned aside my steps and tore me to pieces. He has made me desolate. He bent his bow and set me as a target for his arrows. This is all obviously very Job-like. complaining about the way God has treated him, even though he is God's servant. Verse 12 again, he bent his bow and set me as a target for his arrow. He drove into my kidneys the arrows of his quiver. I have become the laughingstock of all peoples, the object of their taunts all day long. He has filled me with bitterness. He has sated me with wormwood. Having just finished Jeremiah, you remember that he was dealt roughly with by all of the establishment. Their attitude was, this guy is a real downer, and what he's doing is he is sapping the fighting spirit and morale of Israel by his constant saying that God is not with us anymore. Because you remember the false prophets were saying that God was with them, that they just needed to hang in there and things would be okay. And the false prophets also were the ones who instigated the rebellion where Zedekiah rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and that's what caused Nebuchadnezzar to come down the second time and sand the place off. So as he is giving these dire prophecies, he's being mocked, he's being attacked, he's getting thrown in jail, he gets thrown in a pit, he gets beaten, and just does not have a happy existence. In addition to not having a happy existence, he's also prophesying the destruction of the city and the people that are his country. So to be a prophet under those circumstances where you've got to speak for God and God's saying, y'all are going down, it's a bummer having to say that. On top of that, nobody's listening to you except to say you're sapping the morale of our army and our people, and you're contributing to our defeat. So the combination of all that has got Jeremiah, obviously, down in the dump. And quite frankly, I don't blame him. He's got a tough job. Verse 16, he has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance has perished, so has my hope from the Lord. As he goes through all this, he's losing heart. And all of that is very understandable. You all remember in Kings, when Ezekiel has the confrontation with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And he's got this tremendous emotional high when he calls down fire and God sends fire. God soaks up the offering, and then he rounds up all the priests of Baal and slaughters them, every one. So it's kind of an emotional high, if you will. And then the next thing that happens is Jezebel says, the gods do to me and more also if tomorrow you're not just like them, which is to say dead. And at that point he panics and runs to Mount Sinai, where we have, of course, the conversation in the cave. But this emotional roller coaster that some of these prophets go on is very humanly understandable, because since God doesn't send you a prophet when you're doing a good job, he only sends you a prophet to give you a downer message, which is to say shape up or things are going to get really bad for you, that's no fun. So they get roughed up quite a bit. And Jeremiah here is had about as much as he can take, or at least that's what he says. Verse 19, remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. He's asking God to remember what has happened to him. And his soul continually remembers what's happened to him, and his soul bows down, is depressed. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. And by the way, in my translation, that ends with a colon. So the thing that he calls to mind is the next verse. Try it again. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. So even in the midst of despair, which he has spent 19, 20 verses setting up how despairing he is, even in the midst of that despair, he is able to remember God's character and God's covenant. And one of the, I wouldn't call it perks, one of the consolations, comforts, however you want to describe it, is God is talking through you. And you know that he is talking through you. So even though the message is one that you would really rather not be saying, and even though people are upset with what you're doing, you have the comfort of knowing that you are, in fact, in God's will when you're doing it. And that's a tremendous benefit, because most of us go through our lives doing our best and never being sure that we're in God's will. So as tough as being a prophet is, and I'm not a prophet and I'm not volunteering to be one, I can imagine that just the knowledge that God is speaking through you, you have now perfect confidence that he's there. You have perfect confidence that he's engaged. You have perfect confidence that you're walking where he wants you to walk. And even though that walk is very tough, I can imagine that that would be something that would allow him then to remember the steadfast love of the Lord. By this time in history, you've got Psalms and you've got a lot of the history books written. So things like God's love being new every morning and so forth would be something that is part of his culture. And what he is saying here is, as down in the dumps as I am still able to remember this, and this is what gives me hope. Comment was, she has this marked off in her Bible because it's such a wonderful consolation. And that's true. But what I'm saying is the consolation it is to Jeremiah is an order of magnitude greater than the consolation it is to you. Remember in Job, he says, I know my Redeemer lives, and at the latter day I will see him. So Job has this same experience. Jeremiah has got a personal experience with the hand of God upon him, whereas you and I have just read it for a long time, and I firmly believe you believe it, as do I, but it isn't the same degree of intimacy as Jeremiah has here. So we're now down to 25. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. A couple of things there. One of the things that the rabbis have as one of their sayings is you get up in the morning and you put on the yoke of the Torah. And of course, Yeshua then says that my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And the contrast there with the rabbinic understanding or the Pharisaic understanding is that the yoke is something heavy, it's a burden. And what Yeshua is saying is no, it's not intended to be heavy and a burden, it is intended to be something light and enable you to carry your life, if you will, with the yoke. Another way to look at it, it is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. The other way you can look at it is good for a young man to be under discipline, not just growing up willy-nilly. So being under the yoke of his father, of his teachers, etc., until he reaches some degree of wisdom and is able to step out on his own, could also be what's being said here. I'm not sure which way it should be taken, but those are two examples. Jeremiah, of course, as you know, did several pieces of performance prophecy, as did Ezekiel. That seems to have been a thing since the two of them were contemporaries. One of the pieces of performance prophecy is he put on a yoke. So 27:2, Jeremiah, make yourself straps and yoke bars and put them on your neck. Send word to the king of Edom, king of Moab, the king of the sons of Ammon, and so forth. And the idea is he's going to put everybody under the yoke of Babylon, and then the false prophet then breaks the yoke off of him. 28. Let him sit alone in silence when it is laid on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes. Let him be filled with insults. This is the youth who has a yoke. And one of the ways you can read this is young men are feisty and full of pride. And the idea that somebody puts a yoke of discipline on them and occasionally pushes their face into the ground when they need it is one way to look at it. The other thing back in verse 25, the Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. And then 28, let him, the one who is yoked, sit in silence when it is laid on him. So the idea here being patience. And patience, as you know from those of you who have done the Musar course, is a difficult one to learn. And it is especially difficult for the young. As we get older and we slow down, it becomes an easier thing to do. Whereas for a young man, it is very difficult. So I'm not sure that that's what his metaphor means. That's what I'm taking from it. There may be more to it than that, and I'm not seeing it. 31. For the Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love. For he does not willingly afflict or grieve the children of men. The idea here is two ideas at least. He doesn't willingly afflict or grieve the children of men. What that says to me is that most of our trouble is caused by ourselves or by other people not walking in Torah. You have all them heathens out there that aren't walking in Torah. And you have us who don't walk in Torah sometimes. So the afflictions that come upon us are simply the results of not following God's word. And I will suggest that probably 90% of the trouble that people get falls into that category. So God doesn't have to afflict anybody. He just has to stand back and watch when we go off the rails. Having said that, the other thing that is going on here, since it says the Lord will not cast off forever, what we're talking about here is the covenant. Because God has a covenant with Judah and with Israel. And that covenant contains curses for when Israel or Judah go off the rails. They are right now experiencing those curses. But as you remember from Deuteronomy, for example, and every other prophet, what God says is, when I'm done chastening you, I will then return you. And that return may take a long time, but it is part of the covenant. So Jeremiah is seeing, all right, we're in the casting off part of the covenant right now because we have not obeyed, because we have gone into wickedness. It's our own fault, but here we are. But the rest of the covenant says at some point he will restore. So as I'm sitting here thinking of the steadfast love of the Lord, I also have hope that the other side of the covenant is going to kick in, just like the first two parts of the covenant have kicked in. When we were walking in obedience to God, he blessed us just like he said he would. When we went away from God, things got really bad, just like he said they would. Therefore, when we turn our hearts back to God, he will restore. The faith is covenant's working just like it was designed right up to now. There's no reason why it won't continue to work. Pick it up at 33 again. For he does not willingly afflict or grieve the children of men, to crush underfoot all the prisoners of the earth, to deny a man justice in the presence of the Most High, to subvert a man in a lawsuit. The Lord does not approve. The idea here is the reason we are in this mess is because we have violated the Torah. We have created a wicked and unjust society, and when that happens, God is not pleased, and depending on whether you have a covenant with him or not, if you have a covenant with him, he will invoke the clauses of the covenant that are designed to reel you in. If you don't have a covenant with him, there's a couple of things that can happen. Thing one is you can replay Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah didn't have a covenant with God. He simply could not tolerate their behavior, so he took them out. But then option two is he just turns his back and lets you live with the consequences of your stupidity. And I sort of think that's where we are right now. Verse 37, who has spoken and it came to pass unless the Lord has commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and bad come? Why should a living man complain, a man about the punishment of his sins? Who has spoken and it comes to pass unless the Lord commanded it? Remember, we had all of the problems with the false prophets. False prophets accusing Jeremiah of being a false prophet and them being false prophets, so that's part of it. Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and bad come? Why should a living man complain, a man about the punishment of his sins? So if you have done something wrong and you get consequences for having done something wrong, don't complain to God. He's not in it, quite frankly. And the other thing is good and bad coming from the mouth of God. I'm seeing that in relation to the covenant. The covenant has both good and bad listed in it. It has blessings and curses. And those do come from the mouth of God. In addition to the consequences of stupid behavior. So you've got compound interest there. If you're violating the covenant, God will bring the evil parts of the covenant, but you will also reap the consequences of your dumb behavior, which is violating the covenant. Verse 40, let us test and examine our ways and return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. We have transgressed and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. So, in all of the prophets, to include Moses, when Israel goes off the rails, God may chasten them in accordance with the covenant. And he will continue chastening them until they finally get the message and change their behavior and seek his face. You remember in Leviticus 26, it has this cascading sequence of things. First thing is, if you stray from me, I'll chasten you. If you continue straying from me under my chastisement, I will increase it 7 times. And if you still continue to walk contrary to me after that, I'll increase it 7 times again. So the idea is you have this cascading punishment, and the punishment does not stop until you change direction and seek his face. And all of the prophets say the same thing, that when you're up to your hips in Babylonians and you're sitting by the Shebar Canal or wherever it is you're sitting, and you finally come to your senses and you seek the Lord, then the Lord will hear and he will begin the process of restoration. But until you get to that point, he doesn't. The false prophets in Jeremiah are saying, God is not going to let this city be destroyed because we've got the temple right here. We got his house. He's not going to let anybody destroy that. We're safe. And Jeremiah and God say, no, that isn't what's going to happen. But it's the same attitude that you're talking about. We've got God's favor. We've said the sinner's prayer. We're okay. This will never happen to us. And God has not changed. He says he hasn't changed. He's not at all capricious. He tells you what the rules are. And then when you violate the rules, he is long-suffering. He is compassionate. He sends you prophets to try and turn you around. The whole goal of a prophet is not to be a downer and a bummer. It's to get people to change. When you don't, then finally, he looses the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Romans. But that's not his first choice. Choice number one is giving you the rules. This is how my world works. Behave this way and it'll go well with you. When you violate that, he then sends you a prophet. Wait a minute, that's dumb and stupid and evil. Stop doing it. Oh no, I'm not going to do that. And at that point is when he kicks in. The other thing, very quickly, there is a Christian theology called dispensationalism. And what it says is God deals with people by different standards at different times in history. There's a Hebrew word for that. It's called baloney. God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The rules are always the same. He does adjust his punishment according to what you know or should know. So Adam and Eve, one rule, just one. And they became mortal and he moved them out of the garden. As he explains things more, we become responsible for more, but that's because one hopes that we have grown and learned over a period of time. Not that his standards have changed, it's just he's given us more information. The only covenants that God has, except the Noahide covenant, are with Jews. There are no covenants with Gentiles. And we then get to be grafted into the commonwealth. We get to partake of the life of the olive tree, but the covenant is with Hebrews, not Jews, Hebrews. The new covenant is a covenant with Judah and Israel, not with Gentiles. The New Testament is not the new covenant. The New Testament is the new evidence, which is to say the evidence that God kept his word, sent a Messiah, and the Messiah behaved like the prophet said he would. It's entirely evidence. It is not a new covenant. The so-called new covenant is back in Deuteronomy, actually, and that's a covenant with Israel, not Gentiles. 43. You have wrapped yourself in anger and pursued us, killing without pity. You have wrapped yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can pass through. You have made us scum and garbage among the peoples. So the idea of God wrapping himself with a cloud so that our prayers cannot penetrate, once he's decided this is what's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you remember there's one place in, I believe, Jeremiah, where he says, this city is at the point where, though Moses and Samuel were in the city, I wouldn't spare it. So they're going. In fact, at one point he tells Jeremiah, don't pray for this people, don't bother. They're going. 46. All our enemies open their mouths against us. Panic and pitfall have come upon us. Devastation and destruction. My eyes flow with rivers of tears because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. That, of course, is Jerusalem. And one of the things that the prophet says in Jeremiah is the destruction here is going to be so great that people passing by will hiss, as in hiss in horror, not hiss like a villain. 49, my eyes will flow without ceasing, without respite, till the Lord from heaven looks down and sees. My eyes cause me grief at the fate of all the daughters of my city. I have been hunted like a bird by those who were my enemies without cause. They flung me alive into the pit and cast stones on me. Water closed over my head. I said, I am lost. And this may have been when Jeremiah did, in fact, get thrown into a cistern, although the cistern apparently was not full of water, just mud in the bottom. But he's being dramatic. I mean, he's wailing. 55. I call on your name, O Lord, from the depths of the pit. You heard my plea. Do not close your ear to my cry for help. You came near when I called on you. You said, do not fear. You have taken up my cause, O Lord. You have redeemed my life. You have seen the wrong done to me, O Lord. Judge my cause. You have seen all their vengeance, all their plots against me. This feels very much like Jeremiah, because you remember he came from Anathoth, which is a Levite priestly city. And all of the people of Anathoth turned against him when he started prophesying for the Lord. And so he's reminding God of the bad treatment that he got from pretty much everybody here. Verse 61, you have heard their taunts, O Lord, all their plots against me. The lips and thoughts of my assailants are against me all the day long. Behold, they're sitting and they're rising. I am the object of their taunts. You know, Jeremiah is working for God, but nobody likes to have everybody shun them. It just isn't pleasant. So even though you're working for God, to have everybody turning against you is a real downer, and that's what he's saying here. Even though they aren't necessarily physically harming him, they're taunting him, and that's depressing. 64. You will repay them, O Lord, according to the work of their hands. You will give them dullness of heart. Your curse will be on them. You will pursue them in anger and destroy them from under your heavens, O Lord. So Jeremiah is not in a forgiving mood here. And I certainly don't have any idea how God dealt with the people who were harassing Jeremiah. But Jeremiah is ticked. And with good reason. I don't know of anybody who has volunteered to be a prophet. Isaiah is the closest one, where he says, here I am, send me. But he's in the presence of God, and you could sort of think he's overwhelmed with emotion. Oh, wow, I'm in the presence of God. Woo, wow. And he was also a young man at that point, which is kind of rash. But, you know, Moses, for example, tried to turn down the job 3 times. He did not want to do it. And this is why, because when you are speaking for God, the world doesn't want to hear you. And that's Hebrews and Gentiles both. The world doesn't want to hear you when you're speaking for God. So you're going to get this kind of treatment. The cliche is, you know, the crazy guy with a beard that's standing on the courthouse, the end is near. The reason it's a cliche is because of this. This is the way prophets are regarded, whether they're real prophets or false prophets. Unless they're false prophets and they prophesy what people want to hear, then we're okay. But that's not what Jeremiah was doing.